Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. In this latest member profile, Frank Ledwith, a retired university teacher and lecturer, talks about his early life, his interest and involvement with Buddhism, the work of Stephen Batchelor, and what the Middle Way means to him. Hello, Frank. Welcome to the MWF podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, could you begin then by telling us a bit about your early life and background?
Well, I guess the key things about me is that I'm a working class boy by background. And I still am, really, I think, in the way I think. Although I live as a middle class person now.
Yeah.
And the other key thing is I brought up as a Catholic. So I had a very rigid and very condemning kind of view that was put to me about my world.
Yeah.
And that's what I grew up with. And I was really involved in it. And I took it very seriously.
Okay.
But I think by about the age of 16, I came to think that a religion that tells me that I'm fundamentally bad didn't seem to make sense.
Yeah.
That was the thing that really got to me. And then I read some sceptical philosophy and it just blew Catholicism away.
And what about a belief in God? Did you...
All of that.
But when you started questioning it at 16, did you also question the concept of God too?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because the point about sceptical philosophy is anybody makes any absolute claims, you can demolish them.
Yeah.
And it did.
Yeah. So do you still take the sceptical argument seriously?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So that was a real change in your philosophical outlook on life.
Yeah.
Did that affect then your subsequent decisions about career choice and things like that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, by that time, I'd kind of decided that as a working class lad, although that's my background, because one of my uncles said to me, don't ever get a job working with your hands. It's a mug's game.
Right.
So I decided, right, I wouldn't get a job working with my hands. I'd get a job involving my mind, brain. So I decided I was going to go to university.
Okay.
And then teaching and then doing psychology because I was very interested in philosophy, but it didn't seem to be getting anywhere. And I thought, well, psychology deals with data, so maybe we can get a lot further if we actually get some evidence.
But what aspects of philosophy were you interested in?
Epistemology was, you know, the nature of knowledge, the nature of truth, all of that kind of thing.
Okay.
I think much less so involved in moral philosophy at the time. It just happened to be I was very interested in the truth.
Okay. Is that something you're still interested
in?
And do you think we can actually have access to the truth?
In an indirect and partial way, not that there is a truth, but there are truths.
You know? For example?
Well, the Buddhist Four Noble Truths, for example, that there is suffering in the world. Yeah. That there are things, bad things happen in the world. People experience suffering.
Okay.
And there is a way of dealing with that.
Okay.
It's attachment.
So you went to... You studied psychology. Did you specialise in anything?
I did. Surprisingly, I specialised in the physiological end of psychology. And my PhD was actually looking at a particular area of the relation between psychology and human performance.
Okay. And did you manage to apply that in any way?
Well, I did a little. But then for various kind of reasons, people got me involved in the encounter group movement in the 60s and 70s. And what I found there was there's an amazing transformations that occur in people in dialogue with other people. And nothing in my psychology degree had ever prepared me for any of this. And I thought, well, actually, this what I've learned up to now, obviously, is somewhat inadequate.
Just for the uninitiated listener, could you just maybe expand a bit more on what is involved within encounter groups?
Basically, the idea is that we learn by doing in the group.
Yeah.
And what's important, I think, there is that what happens in the group is the data, and it's the data for everybody in the group. So if you and I are in that group and we have some kind of dispute between us, everybody has seen that dispute. I might be angry with you and you might be angry with me, but everybody else there has also witnessed this, and the deal is that you listen to what other people say.
Right.
And then you come to some, try to come to some understanding of what happened, not just from my perspective or your perspective, but from everybody there. So the basic idea behind encounter groups is the voice of everybody counts equally.
Okay.
In that group.
And then I seem to remember that the encounter groups were very popular in the 70s and 80s, but they sort of waned. Why do you think that happened?
I have no idea. I think it just waned.
Yeah.
For all kinds of reasons. There was a great thing about it. I think they're still around in a different way, but it was just the newest thing, and everybody, well, a lot of people were involved in it because they were looking for something, but it must be that in the end it wasn't enough.
Right.
And certainly I found that too, because I got then involved in co-counselling, which is, you know, where you try and help each other to see the world more clearly and to respond to it better. And then the other thing that I was involved in was yoga and the whole relation between the body and the mind and the being, which I'd been doing for a long time anyway. So then eventually went through co-counselling and clearing my mind, and then began to feel there was something missing. And what was missing was the spiritual dimension.
Okay.
You know, the kind of why. Why would we do the way we are? Why is this good and why is that bad?
Mm.
And what's the meaning of it all?
And what, could we just try and pin that down? What does, it often means different things to different people. What does spirituality mean to you?
A sense that there is something bigger than just me. That, you know, if you walk out on a starry night and look up, just, you look at the universe, you know, and you're just, you know, and I look at the stars and I think, these numbers, because I'm quite a numbers person, there are as many galaxies as there are stars you can see. And when you do that, you think, God, I'm so tiny.
Yeah.
The world we are in, so tiny. But I just a feeling that something, there is some sense of meaning in something more than me.
Yeah, okay. Do you think it's also, in a sense, engaging with your deepest experience?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, because the thing is that on the way, I was feeling that I was not being fed by lots of things that kind of looked like food, and they kind of were appetizers, but they weren't enough. I think that's probably what happens with the encounter groups. They do fulfill a need, but when people maybe think, yeah, but that's not enough.
Okay.
There's more to it than life than that.
So how old were you then when you first started getting involved with yoga and this sort of stuff?
In my 30s.
And you were working then?
As a psychologist. Teaching in university.
Yeah, and how was that?
Well, it was fine up to a point, but then I quit.
Why was that?
Well, because I was dedicated to the idea of education.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of enabling people to become more fully human, and I thought university's education was about that. And I kind of analysed education, and I did a Socratic thing about saying, if we want to know what education is, we need to find the finest practitioners of education and see what they're doing. Because Socrates used this about horse training. The nature of horse training is you find horse trainers. So I looked at the educators, my colleagues in the university, and I looked at them. I thought, if that's education, I don't want anything to do with it at all, because it's dreadful. So I quit.
So what were they doing?
What they were doing was giving people facts and testing them on them. And then when they passed, they then said, now you're able to come and join the elite with us.
Yeah, so there was no holistic...
There was no education in there. There was no drawing out of the person.
Yeah.
There was no exploration of the depth of human beings and stuff of that kind. It was just mechanical.
So was that a crisis for you?
Yes.
Yeah. So,
yeah, big crisis.
How did you process that?
Scratched around, tried various things, and then eventually just quit the university without a job.
Right. And so you were unemployed for
about a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then. That wasn't enough. I tried that, and what I finished up doing was drifting back into education. I became a teacher of the Open University because it looked like it might be better, and it is, and was.
So how was it better?
There was much more of, the thing was well organised, and there was very much a concern with the individual. And what we were doing with the Open University were people who had not gone through university route in the ordinary way, gone at 18 and all the rest of it. These were people who were working, doing their own jobs, and then felt that they wanted to learn. And the amazing thing was that many of them actually wanted to learn, and they weren't fussed about the qualification. I remember talking to some of them saying, do you know what, you can get time off for your previous experience, you know, because you don't have to do all the courses. They said, we want to do all the courses. So that was so different.
That's wonderful. I'm just thinking of my brother. He's a systems analyst. He works with computers, etc. But in his 30s, he did a geology degree with the Omni University just for the pure pleasure of learning.
And he
loved it.
So that was... And then eventually I did more of that kind of thing. And then I started using my skills better because I then became a researcher in health policy. So
okay.
I was particularly interested in the issues around smoking. That seemed like a real solid reason, you know, that this was a thing. Smoking was something that people had been persuaded into, and it was damaging their health and killing them.
Yeah.
And if we could find ways of helping people not to smoke or not to start smoking, that would be a useful thing to do.
Sure, yeah. And did that work out? Did you feel that you were making a difference?
I did make a difference. But in the end, I got dissatisfied with that because it seemed to me there was a moral crusade going on amongst the medics that said, you know, smoking is a dreadful thing and should be stopped, and the tobacco companies are evil, etc., etc. But they weren't actually thinking in holistic terms about health. There weren't much issue about poverty, for example,
okay.
which is one of the major determinants of a person's health and well-being, poverty. They weren't doing anything about that. So it seemed to me that they were feeling very good about righteousness. You know, that we're the good ones and they're the baddies, and we can have this crusade. And if we have that crusade, we don't have to really worry very much about what really is important, you know, because we feel we're on the side of the righteous.
Yeah, okay. So how did you deal with that situation?
I then became much more interested in health policy generally, and much more interested in inequalities in health, and in also the relative power of medics and the general health system and complementary therapies and all these other kinds of things which do contribute to well-being. So that's what I was doing, and I used to talk. Well, I then became a university lecturer, and I was usually one of the ones who was telling people the inadequacies of medical science and of psychology.
And were you also politically active in a wider sphere?
Yeah, joined the Labour Party, was part of the Labour Party, and all those kinds of things, and went to branch meetings and tried to do that. And that's a mind-numbingly activity.
But do you think involvement in politics and trying to understand the economics is an important integrative practice?
Well, yes, I think I'm chewing over at the moment. I think it is irresponsible to be thinking about the nature of our world and about suffering and not take the time to try to understand what's actually going on.
Right.
Because if we don't know what's going on and how things work, if we try, we'll just be like a bull in a china shop in trying to make changes. We're just flapping about trying to do something without any understanding about what it is that we're trying to deal with and how it might be dealt with.
What do you think of Russell Brand's evocation for us not to vote?
Well, he doesn't say that, I don't think, or he does say it. What he says is, at the moment, there is nobody worth voting for. And but I do accept his premise that there's something needs to be changed. The present system where we carry on and every 5 years we turn up and vote absolutely will not do.
Mm-hmm.
Because for 5 years governments do what they pretty well want to. And every 5 years we get to say yes or no. Well, that doesn't seem to be enough. And when we're talking about policies, for example, you know, one at the moment is that the current myth is that the Labour Party or the Labour government wrecked the economy, you know, and bankrupted us, and the Tories are now, you know, making it better. Well, they didn't wreck the economy. Absolutely not. The state of the nation at the time when they lost power was much the same as any other country and was no big deal. What wrecked the economy was the financial crisis, because their tax receipts went down and benefits went up, and one of the major benefits was paying the banks billions and billions. So the current narrative is simply wrong, but that's the one that everybody believes, and they believe that the Tories inherited a financial mess, which was the fault of Labour, and they have been doing the very best they can to make it better. No, they haven't. So, unless you understand something economics, actually, you're more likely to believe that, and it's not true.
Okay. Back to your to where we left off your life, what happened then?
Then I seemed to coast along. I was involved in alternative therapy. I was very much involved in trying to evaluate complementary therapies and trying to develop in my teaching and in research a much more holistic approach to health.
Yeah.
So the research I was doing was very much about health systems and involved with other people in trying to say, actually, the complicated things, and let's have a look and understand how they work together.
And did that get much traction?
Not a lot. Yeah. But I was doing it and felt it was a worthwhile piece of research, and, you know, that my voice was one amongst the minority, but we keep at it, yeah. And that was okay.
Do you think there is more receptivity to that now?
Oh, yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, the whole idea of this measures of GDP as the only measure of our society is now finally, I think, being chipped away at, and we now have some alternative. I think there's more awareness of it. And in fact, I heard a couple of programs last night and the night before on the radio about mindfulness and the way it's being taught on the NHS, and it's now being taught in banks and all these other kind of places. So it's the buzz of the moment. Unfortunately, it might be just the buzz of the moment, like encounter groups were, but who knows?
Who knows? But maybe the interest in mindfulness wouldn't have occurred if we hadn't had encounter groups.
Well, I think, I don't know where it's come from. One of the major drivers for it is because there's a huge amount of depression about, and somebody has thought, what can we do about this? And they've come to the idea of mindfulness.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, though, with mindfulness is that you can actually do some empirical testing with it. So science likes it because, you know, it's not just qualitative, it's quantitative to an extent.
You actually measure how long people go without their next depression kind of thing.
Or people who have cirrhosis, you know, they do control groups, and ones that are doing meditation, you can actually physically measure the difference in how their condition is recovering. So
yes, and the other one is in pain clinics, and there you can measure the amount of medication people are taking for pain and the reported levels of pain, and yes, they do improve with mindfulness. So yeah, there are demonstrable outcomes that people can use. But why it came to that, I think a few people thought there's a problem and they found this one and then said, I think this might work, and it did.
Sure, yeah. Okay, well, we touched on Buddhism before. Yeah. When was your interest first sparked with that?
I think.
And what was your journey with that?
Well, the journey was that it was not knowing, wanting something different, and going to Sami Ling, the Buddhist monastery up in Scotland.
Yeah.
I can't remember how I first went there. I think it might have been for a yoga course or something like that. But when I went there, as soon as I got there, I thought, this is different. There is something about this place which I like. Sense of purpose, of peace, and the idea of an approach which is non-hierarchical and really wants to look at the nature of reality and the meaning of life without necessarily having a huge superstructure like the church. I've subsequently discovered that Buddhism has the superstructures just as much as the Catholic Church, but never mind. I still like the idea of what that place represents.
So, with these sort of arguably more metaphysical elements to them, or doctrinal elements, do you take a pragmatic view to them?
Well, I try to immerse myself in them, because I went to a number of courses where there was a man there, an really excellent teacher, who was very much involved in the doctrinal approach in Buddhism. And just after a time began to think, wait a minute, you know, some of this stuff sounds dreadful. You know, when we're talking about devils and hell and all these kind of things, that sounds exactly like the Catholic Church. Devices to frighten people into being good. So then, you know, I was becoming increasingly unhappy with that. And then the whole business of reincarnation and karma, and that we do things in this life so we won't be come back as a beetle, and eventually we'll get out of this circle of suffering. Reincarnation didn't make any sense to me, and I thought I could see a logical problem in it, that, you know, if the ego or the self is an illusion, then what does karma attach to? You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't have an ego that doesn't exist and have an entity to which karma attaches. Yeah. So there's a logical problem with that, and I puzzled over it for years. I asked this man, Ken, about this, and his only answer said, well, you could think of it one way in one way of thinking and think it another way in another way of thinking. And so I thought, yeah, okay, well, I'm used to the idea of dilemmas, but it still makes sense. And then I read Stephen Batchelor's work, and then I thought, ah.
So what was it you liked about Stephen's work?
Going back to the basics, like stripping away all of the stuff which might have accreted to Buddhism, and let's going back to what the Buddha actually said and what he did. And also Stephen Batchelor saying enlightenment wasn't the end of life, which is what the message I got up at Sami Ling, that once you've got become enlightened, that's it, game over. Whereas what Stephen was saying, you become enlightened and then you start dealing with the world. And I thought, yeah, okay, it's not the end of the journey.
Yeah. So it's the idea is it's a process.
It's a process, and once you become enlightened, then you start to operate in the world in a different way, a better way, one hopes. But that's what you're doing. You're not trying to store up something for a future life. You're just doing it right now.
But do you have this idea that enlightened is a... say it's a sort of perfect state or
no, I mean, that's the way it's presented. I don't see it that way. I mean, I think I see it as a progressive state where you become more enlightened as you go. In Sami Ling, that it sounds like, you know, that's it. That's the one you're aiming for, and anything less is kind of lesser. Whereas I think of it in terms of it's a process and it would be never ending.
Okay, my last question, Frank, is how do you understand the middle way, and how might you relate it to your life?
My middle way, the way I understood middle way, is not the way that the middle way society talks about it, I don't think. My thinking about the middle way in Buddhism, the middle way is between a straight spiritual explanation. There's nothing but mind. There's nothing but spirit, or there's nothing but reality, but, you know, solid reality.
Yeah.
The middle way is to say they're both. Okay. That's what I saw. The way I see the middle way society seems to be, it has really anti-metaphysical statements. You know, doesn't want metaphysical statements. I have no great problem with metaphysical statements. I do have a problem with some, like saying there's a God and all those kinds of things. But, and there are lots of things. But I think metaphysical statements can be okay. For example, a statement that every event in the world has a cause. Now, that's a metaphysical statement. Mm. But actually, it's a working hypothesis in science. You know, we don't go along saying, well, there might be a cause. You say, all right, if there's something happened, something's caused it. So that's how you work. And you say, we'll keep on with that working hypothesis until we find it doesn't work.
But then arguably that's not a metaphysical statement if it's a hypothesis, because that's...
No, well, but it's the same thing. If I say... every event has a cause, you can call it a metaphysical statement or you can call it a working hypothesis. Well,
but I suppose it's whether you believe when you say it that in an absolute sense rather than a provisional sense.
Well, if you ask most scientists, they would say, of course it's true. They wouldn't even question it, you know. So I suppose for them, they're using it as a metaphysical statement. I wouldn't use it that way.
Yeah.
And if they press hard about it, eventually you'd probably get them to say, well, yeah, actually, it is a working hypothesis. Suppose the danger is if they believe it's absolutely true.
Well, if you look at something like the speed of light, I mean, that's seen as a constant, but you know, there is evidence to suggest now that there are fluctuations in the speed of light. Might be very minimal, but it's not absolute.
Well, except, I mean, the speed of light is always said to be at a particular speed in particular circumstances. So some people take it as an absolute. It isn't what they're saying. But the C in MC squared is actually not the speed of light. It's the universal constant, and that happens to be the speed of light. It's an accident. as far as I can see. But the universal constant isn't accident, okay, because it's the nature of our universe, apparently. So the two are, we talk about the speed of light, but it's not actually that. That's not what the constant is. It's the universal constant, as I understand it, but I'm not a physicist.
Okay. And then what was it that made you decide to join the society?
Well, you told me about it. And I'm interested in ideas, and I'm interested in the idea of people sharing ideas.
Yeah.
I know that if you went to Samuel Ling and tried to share some of the ideas, they would say, don't be ridiculous. you're obviously, you haven't done enough meditation to join in the argument, really. Yeah. But to find, you know, a group of people who might be prepared to discuss these things and be open-minded about them, and then, you know, that sounded okay.
Yeah, smashing. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Frank. Thank you very much for giving up your time.
Well, I enjoyed it.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.